Hi everyone, Happy New Year. Welcome to this first episode of the UKIS ITEL podcast for 2024. I'm delighted to have not one but two eminent guests with me this week. Sarah Hobolt, Sutherland Chair of European Institutions and Professor at the LSE, our less illustrious neighbour. And she's a fellow of the British Academy to boot and has worked for years on and off with UK and a changing Europe. And Sir John Curtis, who's Professor of Politics, Strathclyde University, Senior Research Fellow at UK and a Changing Europe and NatSen, and apparently hosts a competitor podcast. So, welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
Hi, Annan.
Polling is what I want to talk to you about, because you're both amongst the sort of best in the academic game at studying, writing about, assessing public opinion. When you look at, we've seen a lot in the last few weeks of chatter about polls in the newspapers and with politicians. Do you sometimes sort of look at that and roll your eyes and think, you know, these people just need to think about these things a bit more carefully? Or do you think actually we're quite good in public discourse at talking about and using polls?
I think we focus too much on polls. When we think about, it becomes all about the horse race of politics when it's polling. It becomes all about who's winning, who's 2 points ahead or 20 points ahead. And it becomes less about the content of the choice that face voters. So I think the problem is the media likes it because it becomes, is this called a kind of two men or two women or, you know, horse race. But I think what we lose out on is the dialogue about what are the differences in terms of the choices that voters face.
It's a very academic answer, Sarah. I mean, academics are interested in the underlying forces and motivations, etc., whereas the horse race does. But to be honest, this is not unique to polling, right? This is generally true that there is a very heavily interest in journalism about who's up and who's down, as opposed to perhaps some of the intricacies but important features of public policy. I mean, to be honest, Alan, I could actually turn it around and say, well, actually, it's surprising the extent to which people end up being surprised by polling results that some of us have gone, what's new here? Why are you surprised? There's nothing remarkable here. So if we take, for example, a now somewhat infamous opinion poll published in the Daily Telegraph in the middle of January, which was sponsored by a somewhat unknown Conservative organisation, which said that the Conservatives might end up with 160 seats. I went, sure, actually that sounds quite generous to the Conservatives, given all the polling evidence that we've got out there. And indeed, I personally wrote something for the Sunday Telegraph in the middle of December saying it could be 130 seats. So it's amazing sometimes how long it can take, the fact that, you know, basically 15 months worth of polling data have been pointing to a result of that kind of inclination. All of a sudden people say, oh gosh, you know, you mean it really could be? Yes, it really, actually, potentially could be if the polls are at all right. So to that extent, you know, I think one can perhaps exaggerate the extent to which polls dominate things. I think what's also true, by the way, is that even in media that commission polls. So, for example, let's just take The Observer. I'm not picking on The Observer, it's just an example. It is very, I mean, The Observer faithfully, pretty much every fortnight, helps to pay for a poll done by Opinion. It's very rare that it makes any kind of headline, even on page 9 of The Observer. And it's often buried in another story about, you know, what Sir Keir Starmer is going to promise about this or Rishi Sunak is going to say about that. The Times does YouGov polls every week. Sometimes it makes it a bit of a headline. It's going often buried. Now, if you were to go back, you know, 20, 30 years, when, of course, there were many fewer polls, but they were much more expensive, if a newspaper had decided to go to the expense of sponsoring a poll, it was almost guaranteed to be on the front page. So to that extent, at least, actually, because we've got more polls, ironically, and because they are now cheaper, ironically, I think perhaps they're to some extent actually more easily ignored, including even by the organisations that sponsor them.
OK, I'm going to come back to a whole load of that. I was struck by you saying a relatively little-known Conservative organisation. I think you meant a completely and utterly unknown until that moment Conservative organisation. But Sarah's, I want to come back to Sarah's point, because, I mean, A, because I think I tend to agree with her, and B, because I'm not sure, is it an academic point? Because actually, the serious point behind this surely is that politics has become pantomime, and polling is part of that pantomime, who's up, who's down. And actually, the things that affect people in their day-to-day lives isn't pantomime, it's policy. And you see all the time that policy gets relatively short shrift. It's
sure, but and all I'm saying is there's nothing new about that. Okay, that you know, you just have to understand journalistic news values, and journalistic news values are very much toyed around who's up, who's down, not least, of course, because many of those who are responsible for reporting our politics spend their life in and around the lobby and the Palace of Westminster. And they spend a lot of time talking to MPs, etc. And, you know, when I read reports or hear on the television or radio, oh, Tory MPs or some Tory MPs have told me this, or they think the electorate will go say that, I kind of go, well, actually, I'm not quite sure whether the views of Conservative MPs are necessarily any more or better informed than anybody else I might get off the street. But of course, the point is that's the world that they operate in. That's the world in which journalists who occupy the Palace of Westminster have their unique selling proposition. And I always kind of make the point, look, I don't occupy that world. What I do is to read the tables in polls, and I do try to understand some of the underlying forces. But that, in a sense, is because one is standing back from the immediate forum through which a lot of media stories get generated.
I mean, Sarah, go on, were you going to come in anyway?
Well, I think one issue is that it's not just that the media and journalist focuses a lot on polls, but as John mentions, polls have just gotten a lot cheaper. You can get them a lot more quickly. So there's also a sense that politicians and parties use them a lot more as a sort of, you know, every time they want to run a policy, have a new policy, you have the sense that they have been passed at least a focus group and then probably also some kind of representative sample. And I do think it raises some sort of larger normative questions, whether it's moved politics in the direction of a sort of, oh, let's pander to the public, or policy by focus group, because politicians are so scared of being a little bit less popular in the polls and for a short time. And they have the means to all the time look at the most recent polls and poll everything they do. So it becomes this sort of idea that, oh, that's more democracy, that's what we really want. But often I think perhaps what voters want is better policy and some policy leadership, as opposed to just politicians that are obsessed with polling and polling data and focus group data.
Yeah, but again, hang on, Sarah. Right, let's go to the person who was supposedly dominated particularly by the messages of focus groups, as I'm pointing out more broadly, which was Tony Blair's regime. And the argument was that what he and Philip Gould, who was his arch pollster, who particularly did a lot of focus groups, were doing, were identifying where the public at and moving the Labour Party to where the public were at. We now know from a lot of research that had been done in the wake of the new Labour government that actually what Labour did was to move their own supporters towards the centre, and in so doing helped to achieve what Margaret Thatcher failed to achieve, which was to move the UK public further to the right. So these were a group of people who supposedly were dominated by the focus group and the opinion polls, but actually they were people who were moving their party in a direction in which they were anyway more comfortable and which they believed in. And I think eventually, subsequently, we discovered that actually Tony Blair was not somebody who simply followed focus groups, but actually somebody who had some quite clear ideological views, not least, of course, with respect to foreign policy. So I think, again, one can, do not underestimate the extent to which politicians look at data and evidence through a partisan lens, i.e. they look for the things that accord with the views that they already have. So, you know, at the moment, I mean, although there was plenty of evidence out there that says tax cuts, is this really what the public wants? Is this really going to be electorally efficacious? But probably I could do a dozen presentations to a dozen group of Tory MPs and not one of them would be willing to accept that seems, at the moment at least, to be the evidence that actually probably, in focusing on tax cuts, they're probably barking up the wrong tree.
And I suspect, in so doing, quite a few of them would say things like, oh, that's the way the question is worded, which brings me to my next point, which is, do we regulate polling enough? Should it be regulated? I mean, I saw a poll today that was doing the rounds on social media about do you prefer Rishi Sunak to a conservative leader who has conservative values or something? It was a very, very oddly worded thing. It was, as Rob Ford put it on Twitter, it was Rishi Sunak versus a pony. Is it problematic that polls like that are allowed to get out there? How are polls regulated, first and foremost?
I need, first of all, to declare an interest. At the moment, I'm president of the British Planning Council and have been for the last 16 years, and it has a role in regulating polls. There's essentially what's grown up is a two-legged form of self-regulation. The first is the British Planning Council, which I've already mentioned, which enforces standards of transparency. So you are able to tell me what the exact wording of what the question was, because under British Planning Council rules, YouGov have a responsibility and an obligation to make the details of the question wording known, and lots of other information behind. And the philosophy behind that essentially is, well, actually, yeah, if, as Rob Ford has said, I think that's a crap question, he has the evidence on which to do so. And everybody and anybody has the evidence upon which to make their judgment. That's number one. Now, what is also true is that the Market Research Society, if pollsters are members of the Market Research Society, they do have a set of professional standards and ethics that people are required to uphold. The trouble is, you can get into some pretty contested waters, because anybody who's ever been involved in questionnaire design knows that this is a subject on which people with quite substantial degrees of professional experience may well have honest disagreements. So, for example, there was one judgment recently whereby the Market Research Society, their professional adjudication panel, you know, upbraided an organisation because they didn't include "don't know" as an option on an opinion poll. Well, to be honest, sometimes we deliberately don't want to give respondents "don't know." And certainly if we then also think of the particular interest, which is something Sarah has been very heavily involved in, the interest in creating experimental designs in which we deliberately cue voters in one direction or another in a way that some people might say, well, hang on, you're asking biased questions. Well, if we were to start trying to regulate and say, before you can ask a poll question, you have to ask an organisation in a way that there is such regulation in France, a lot of the freedom that academics would value with respect to the design of questions on questionnaires, etc., etc., would also begin to be questioned. So to be honest, I personally take the view that this is one of those areas where get the evidence out there and then you can be as critical as you want of any form of polling. But the point is that there are always reasonable grounds for disagreement about whether or not, A, the questions are reasonably worded or not, or B, certainly about the way in which we interpret them. And that is what, in a democratic society, we should be able to do.
Sorry, you're nodding.
No, I fully agree with John. And perhaps adding to that, I think here journalists, again, play a very important role, and some are excellent at it and some less so, in terms of how polls are presented and interpreted. Every year when I teach sort of surveys and survey methodology, I have a lot of examples from a whole range of newspapers that just use polls in a way that, you know, which they can't be used. And, you know, question wording is one example. Another one is just how to treat uncertainty. You'll see a shift in sort of 1 or 2 percentage points, and that will be interpreted as some massive shift in public opinion, which of course it can't be. So I think that would go a long way. I don't think regulation is the answer. I think transparency is important, exactly as John pointed out. And then that we have good reporting and good critical reporting of polling and the interpretation. And of course, having John always on the radio and the TV explaining it with such great clarity and expertise also goes a long way.
But that's all, I mean, that this is an area also where the British Polling Council has been active. So, as indeed has also been the Market Research Society. There are various guides out there for journalists about how they should report polls. The National Council for the Training of Journalists also now has an online course. And by the way, so far as uncertainty is concerned, if you are any British Polling Council member that publishes a poll of voting intentions, there is a stipulated statement that's designed to give an indication that, you know, basically any movement that's much more than about 4% on historical basis, you shouldn't really be taking too much notice of. But of course, we cannot regulate journalists. And let's bear in mind, given the extent to which the current government has been gradually steering away from the attempt to regulate the press more closely that occurred in the wake of the whole row about phone hacking. So I don't think you can look forward to any serious regulation of the way in which journalists report polls. And indeed, arguably, that is regulated and is, to a much later extent than the way in which the polling industry is operating at the moment.
And Sarah, I mean, one of the things you do is you study public opinion across a variety of countries. Do other countries do this differently? And dare I ask, do other countries do this better?
Well, I mean, polling is, you know, there are certain countries that have particular rules, speaking of regulation, about whether or not you can report polls just leading up to an election. So that's one of the main differences. And that goes back to a sort of interesting question about whether not just how politicians use polls, but also whether voters themselves are shaped, their opinions and even their voting behavior is influenced or shaped by polls. And I guess in some countries they think, yes, that is a problem. So they actually don't allow polls to be reported just before an election.
But that's also become much more difficult because of the internet. Because all you now need to do, if you want to, if a country tries to have a polling ban, all you need to do is to put it up on a website that is outside the domain of that country, which is one of the reasons why a number of the countries that used to have quite lengthy bans on the publication of polls, e.g. France, it's now down to about 24 hours. And at that point, people seem to be willing to abide by it. But the internet has basically pretty much destroyed the ability to.
And I think what the internet's also done is just that polling is not really sort of a national thing. I mean, these polling companies that operate here in the UK, many of them operate across Europe, across the world. So it's very much international business, and pollsters learn from each other and they operate internationally. So we see it very much as a, now that we're no longer knocking on doors how we used to, but rather mainly asking people to online, we also see it becoming much more internationalized.
Yeah, the standards, I mean, the other thing to say about regulation is that the standards on transparency in the UK are probably the most wide-ranging of all. Australia has now imitated what we do. But for example, even if even polls done in the Irish Republic, you won't necessarily see the tables up on the web. And you may have seen from some of the attempts that were made to investigate what went wrong in the polls in the US in 2020, for example, not all polling companies have necessarily collaborated with that, whereas British Polling Council members are all under an obligation to collaborate with any inquiry that the British Council may mount with respect to the way in which polls were conducted and their accuracy. So you should be aware of the extent to which the industry in the UK does really maintain standards that are, frankly, probably at the top of the tree so far as transparency is concerned.
Hi, everyone. This is what proper podcasters would call a commercial break, where I read out a message from our sponsor. But we don't have a sponsor, so this is a message from us. It's a big year in terms of elections around the world. And of course, here in the UK, we're expecting our general election to be this year. And to mark that and to help you keep up to date with what's happening in global politics, we've launched our new election coverage page on our website. So go to ukneu.ac.uk/general-election for all our election coverage, elections around the world, and a lot of detail from the best polling experts on what to expect here. Have a look. Let us know what you think. And going back to where we started, Sarah, my question, real curiosity. You know, we were talking about pantomime politics here and not enough discussion of policy. Are there countries in Europe where there is more sustained discussion of policy, do you think, where that balance is slightly different, or are we all in the same place?
Well, there are certainly countries in Europe where, well, generally, it's just much harder to have the kind of horse race politics in countries that have a more fragmented political system and that doesn't have the kind of first past the post system that we have in the US is, of course, the extreme example of pantomime politics. I mean, even before Trump, you would have two presidential candidates. So, of course, everything, even though the US political system is quite complicated, everything becomes about those two presidential candidates. And, you know, even though we have a parliamentary system here, we've become, there's the personalization of politics, the degree to which it's Sunak versus Starmer, you know, has also been increasing. And that's the, you know, as John explained, that's kind of with journalistic sort of incentives to make this about that kind of politics, that race between two characters, two people, that's very attractive. That's easier to do in the UK than it is in a system where you have 10, 15 parties, and what it's really about is kind of complicated coalition formation. I mean, one of the examples where it's perhaps hardest to have that kind of politics is in the European Union. So the upcoming elections to the European Parliament. I mean, I remember discussing this at the BBC, and they were like, well, how do we make that into interesting television? Because all we can do is photograph some buildings. What we want are like knowing who are the main character, who's fighting whom, who's up, who's down, who's in, who's out. And that's just very complicated in that kind of consensual coalition politics that characterizes Europe.
Just before, I want to talk about the European elections a little bit, actually. I want to talk about the UK elections as well. But actually, you can do as a public service, one of you, and just explain, assume that I'm an idiot, all right, and don't laugh, John. MRP, is it the holy grail of public opinion polling? What is it? And if it's so good, why is it so good?
It's not the holy grail. It came to prominence in the 2017 election, at which there were two exercises, one of which, one done by YouGov, came closer to anticipating the fact that Theresa May was not going to get an overall majority than did the other, or indeed did most of the opinion polls. So what is it? It's essentially an attempt to conduct polling in such a way that, given in the United Kingdom what people are most interested in, it's not the share of the vote that the parties win, but the number of seats they're going to get in the House of Commons. To be able to address that seat question more directly than you can do from an opinion poll of 1,000 people. So essentially, what is done is that you conduct an opinion poll with, shall we say, many thousands of people. And that opinion poll gives you an idea about how, for example, women aged 35 to 44 with a degree and one child, the probability of them voting for each party. Census and other data then gives you information about the number of people with that and many other characteristics that exist in each and every constituency. And so therefore, what you can then do is to use the fact that you know how people in different demographic groups and other political groups, etc., how they say they're going to vote at present. You know how many of the people, these people there are in each constituency, and therefore, essentially, you can break the constituency down to its component parts, work out how each group is going to vote, add it back up, and you get a forecast for that constituency of what the outcome is going to be. And you can then do that for all 632 constituencies in Great Britain. The thing that it's certainly superior to, and or at least seems to be better than doing, and what it's largely taken out of the frame, is attempts to do constituency polls. In other words, you do a poll of a thousand people in Reigate or in Guildford or Inverness or whatever. That's now virtually fallen out of the polling lexicon. The record on it, not very good. Now, the reason why it particularly got attention, as I said, in 2017, two such attempts, one actually done by Lord Ashcroft, wasn't particularly successful, no more successful than the general polls, which in that election tended to underestimate Labour's prospects. But the YouGov MRP poll actually slightly underestimated the Conservatives' position. But because that was much closer to the journalistic story, which was actually the Conservatives weren't going to get an overall majority, it then attracted attention. Now, actually, then in 2019, when YouGov did it, it wasn't particularly bad or particularly good. It's just that, well, A, the polls, the general polls were more accurate, and B, the YouGov poll ended up in terms of the anticipated seat outcome being very close to what you would get if you simply took a standard average of the standard national polls and did some fairly simple arithmetic. That's basically the history. The advantage is it gives you an answer in terms of seats. It's not, however, necessarily more accurate. It's just that in its first outing, it proved in one of two instances to get closer to the story that everybody was interested in. And that's the legacy that it's still living with.
Interesting. Sarah, do you want to add anything?
Just that obviously it's very useful in political systems like the British, where we're interested in constituencies and seats, and much less relevant in systems where you have proportional representation and where you're really interested in national swings.
Yeah. No. And talking of which, I want to turn briefly to the European elections that are coming up. And we've talked about this before, Sarah, and, you know, media here seem obsessed with this idea of, you know, the coming far-right wave, and that's all they want to talk about in terms of the European elections. But there's some there are some other really interesting things at stake in these elections, aren't there?
I think the reason the media is interested in this is you know, twofold. First of all, it does suggest, if you look at the forecast now, that this is going to be the major story, that we do have a shift to the right in the European Parliament, that elections that will take place in June this year. And not only the right, but sort of really the far right, the Eurosceptic Conservatives group and the sort of radical right, and that those are the two major groups that will gain seats. So that's obviously important potentially for the European Parliament itself, but also it says something about general trends in a lot of European countries. We've seen most recently in the Netherlands, where Geert Wilders won the most seats in the Dutch Parliament. And we've seen, of course, a radical right-wing government in Italy, and so on. So a number of countries, France coming up potentially with the radical right winning the next presidential elections, if we trust the polls this far out. So it's a sort of a general trend in Europe that many are concerned about. When we think about the European Parliament, however, perhaps in some ways it's less significant than those national trends, because the centre will still, even on current forecasts, suggest that they will have hold a majority of the seats. The kind of centre-left and centre-right together will have a kind of grand coalition that looks like they'll still dominate, and they'll still dominate likely most of the legislative work in the European Parliament. But it is a real shift in terms of public opinion on the continent.
And also, one of the focuses of this is because people try to read across from what might be happening in European Parliament elections to what might happen in national elections. Is there that sort of interrelationship? So, you know, I'm sure there'll be all sorts of lazy headlines about the Rassemblement National in France if they do well in the European elections, about the presidential election to come, or the AfD in Germany. Is there some sort of causal relationship between how well you do in European parliamentary elections and what happens nationally, or they're totally separate things?
So they're separate elections in the sense that when voters vote in European Parliament elections, in a way they're freer than they often will be in national elections, because they're what academics like to call second order national elections. So people tend to treat them in a way, because they're not about electing the president or electing the prime minister, people tend to think, oh, now we can express our sincere preferences, or perhaps we can sort of express our sort of protest vote against the current government. And so in that sense, you tend to see the extremes, whether on the left or the right, do better. However, you asked about causal election, and there a causal connection between the European and the national level. And interestingly, there is political science evidence that when a party, especially, for example, a party on the far right, does well in a European Parliament election, that does predict how well they'll do in the next national election. It provides a kind of foothold, and not just because of voters would say, oh, they have certain credibility, whether that be Le Pen's party. We saw it with UKIP and the Brexit party in Britain. We've seen it with AfD in Germany, but also because they get funding. So they get a kind of organizational foothold that they often haven't had domestically. So they get a lot of funding from being represented in the European Parliament. So what we've seen in Europe across the last two decades is that it has provided a sort of a platform for the radical right in particular, that has also benefited them domestically.
Yeah, I mean, Sarah's made a very important point. And, you know, certainly I think, you know, the rise of UKIP in the United Kingdom was certainly facilitated by its ability to get elected to the European Parliament.
Yeah.
And arguably, you know, the Greens have profited in that way to some degree as well. That said, so far as saying, well, is this necessarily going to predict in the short term, we should remember that in the last European Parliament elections to be held in the United Kingdom in May 2019, the Brexit Party came first and the Liberal Democrats came second. This did not prove to be a signpost to what they achieved just literally 7 months later in the 2019 general election.
But Britain, of course, is a complete outlier.
I
mean,
oh,
for two reasons. Everyone knew that Britain would be at that point leaving. But more importantly, also here we have two very different electoral systems. And so that's not. So therefore, you can't really make the direct comparison with the rest of Europe, where you tend to operate with proportional representation, both at the European Parliament election and and in a national election. So of course, yes, it's definitely not a direct translation, but the difference you tend to see is much starker in the UK than what you see in other EU member states.
Sure, point taken.
And actually, when we're talking about differences, I just have to give a plug to a series of radio programmes done by Sarah's longtime co-author, James Tilley, on the radio about young voters and how across the continent, and it's a thing that surprises many Brits, a lot of young voters opt for far-right parties. It's a really interesting set of short programmes that I recommend to you most strongly. I'm dying to ask you questions about that, but we're not going to have time. But I want to end just quickly, John, by talking about our election. First simple question, when is it?
14th of November.
Okay, you and George Osborne.
John has some inside information there.
Well, no, it's not inside information.
Can we go and put our money on that now, John?
That's entirely up to you. I don't bet. So basically, the assumption is that the Conservatives will not be in a position to hold an election at the beginning of May. And I mean, I've long been of that view for the simple reason that the choice facing Rishi Sunak is to bank 2 years as Prime Minister versus risking it after 18 months. And given that defeat is going to mean the end of his political career, the odds have to be for him to bank the 2 years and perhaps ensure that the legislation required to resort in the end in an end to tobacco smoking in the UK gets through. And that's probably going to be the legacy that gets mentioned 30 years hence. But the reason, particularly for the 14th of November, is that the political parties have moved their party conferences forward to earlier in the autumn. And the last conference, which is the Conservative conference, ends on the 2nd of October. These conferences are now quite important money raisers, so it's thought that the parties will be reluctant to lose them and therefore be able to hold an election in October before the clocks go back. But if Rishi Sunak therefore decides to call the election on the 2nd of October as part of his closing speech to the Tory party conference, given you then need a little bit of time to sort out the legislation, you are looking at the 14th of November as the likely legal date. And given the Parliament in principle could go through to begin, go through to January 2025, but that given the way in which the law works, that would require the official legal campaign to start on the 17th of December, and I somehow suspect that in a country which basically goes into hibernation for 10 days over Christmas and New Year, the idea of holding election campaign during that festive period is basically just a no-no. And the Prime Minister has effectively acknowledged that already.
And I mean, if you're talking November, it's a long way away, isn't it?
Of course it is.
So, you know, apart from, you know, making the most of his time in number 10 and getting himself a legislative legacy, there must also, I mean, if you were Prime Minister, be thinking something will come up, whether it's the economy recovering, whether it's unexpected, totally unexpected events that swing things. I mean, you wouldn't be just giving up, would you? You'd be just hanging on and hoping that
it's perfectly clear this government's not giving up. It's just that every single one of the initiatives in which it is so far engaged, beginning with the change in some of the net zero policies back in the middle of September, absolutely, and ending most recently with the Rwanda bill, absolutely none of those did anything to raise Conservative support in the opinion polls. The Conservatives at the moment, as we speak, are running at 25%, which is exactly where they were in the immediate wake of the downfall of Liz Truss. Mr. Sunak has been in power for 15 months and has basically not succeeded in raising his party's popularity over the longer run. And now he's got, 10 months left. And you can see why Conservative MPs are asking whether the next 10 months are in any way going to be different from the previous 15.
Yeah, interesting. I mean, are you one of those that sort of thinks that potentially the electoral interests of the Conservative Party and those of the Prime Minister are slightly different? I mean, a lot of people...
Yes, it's not obvious to me at the moment that the Conservative Party is... That there is particularly good reason why the Conservatives would do significantly better in May. But certainly, if you take the view that if, however well or badly he loses... If Rishi Sunak loses, he will no longer be leader of the Conservative Party within a matter of weeks, and he will probably have no chance again of pursuing a significant political career. that to that extent, at least, the odds, even if going slightly earlier would result in a slightly less heavy defeat, I think that's frankly irrelevant to him. So why should he go early?
Okay, Sarah, any thoughts on either timing or where we're at in the UK?
Well, I'm certainly not going to. If John is saying it's the 14th of November, then I'm straight down the betting shops and putting
my
money on that.
You were just putting it in your diary, were you?
Oh, and in the diary. I mean, the European Parliament elections are a bit easier to predict since that we know when they are. Well, I mean, it's not looking that great for the Conservatives. And one thing, going back to polling, which we discussed at the very beginning, what's interesting is that actually the polls are very stable. So we're not seeing, you know, we have policy initiative after policy initiative and the government is trying different things, you know, stop the boats, tax cuts. But, and, you know, John will correct me if I'm wrong, but the way I look at it, it just looks incredibly stable, which is not good news for the Conservatives, but it suggests that what they're doing is not really working, which is, of course, why some, I guess, Tory MPs are getting a bit jittery and a bit nervous about these upcoming elections, and which is why I would think that if you are a Conservative Prime Minister, you wouldn't want to rush it. You'd want to wait as long as you can and hope that things will somehow change.
Yeah, well, we'll get some more evidence in the couple of by-elections that are coming and then the local elections in May, but I'm afraid not only have we run out of time, but I've slightly overrun, so my apologies to the two of you, but thank you so, so much for that. I'm pretty sure we'll be hearing from both of you in UK and the Changing Europe again before too long in this year of elections, but for the moment, I just want to say that was great, really interesting as always, and I'm really grateful that you've spared the time, so thank you.
Thank you.